We started speaking last week. About the faculty of speech. He said that an ability to speak is to make a connection between the higher and the lower world. We won't go over that again. Moshe Rabbeinu was a person who was able to bring a word from a higher dimension down into this world. And that's what Torah is. Torah is a speech, a word, a speaking, which means it's the bridge between two mystical or spiritual levels. Now, let's look this week at the next step in that process. And that's the process of hearing. Now, the whole subject is only hints, because the faculty to hear, the ability to be able to hear correctly, mystically, is one of the deepest subjects in the mystical writing. Now, we can just speak about it, just say the word simply. But you have to have a faculty that we've always discussed here, which is the inner sensitivity called the das, to be able to hear what this thing really is in its depth. Because that can never really be conveyed in words. The problem here is going to be to try and express how deep this thing goes. Now, superficially, when you hear something, so the words enter your ears, and you hear the sound, and you understand what's being said. But actually, this figure goes to the heart of creation, starts with the very beginning of the creation of the world, and it affects every aspect of the creation, and in practical terms, the ability to hear correctly affects every second of our life. Because just like all other spiritual qualities are dying, more powerfully perhaps than any of them, that's the ability to hear properly, that if not already dead, only thrashing around in a death throes in this generation. That means that the process has gone so far that people spend 50 years together, that's what we've come to now. People can spend an intimate life together for 50 years and not have begun to hear what each other was saying from the beginning. Sometimes people end up after 50 years and realize that they never understood one thing that was being said to them from the beginning. Let's try and understand this thing at its root and get some... It's a heavy subject. But the first clue, you know, that we have a tradition when we want to track down a sugya, want to understand a Torah idea, and then we have rules where we try and trace it. The rules are that you look at the root of creation. For example, if you want to track an idea and see what its root form looks like in spiritual terms, you look where that idea is contained in the Aleph Beis. Because the Aleph Beis, the letters, are the roots, the building blocks of anything in the world. You'll try and show a little bit more how deep that goes. So therefore, if you could look at what the word means in terms of its structure of its letters, or what they equal in numbers, or the shape of the letters, that would be a very special place to begin. And we have many rules like this. One of the rules is that we try and trace the source back to the first time it's mentioned in Chumash. There's a principle from the Kabbalists that the first time something is mentioned in Chumash, that's the root of the idea. That sets the pattern, the creation of that idea in the world, for everything that it will be from then on in. So if you want to understand something deeply, we go back to the 6 days of creation, and you see when that thing came into existence. Because there, you see the rules of its formation. So if you want to take the manual back, let's say, to the construction of the machine, then you go back to the stage when the thing's being built, as the pieces are put together, and you see what it is. So let's take this idea, let's try and trace it in Chumash, when the Chumash talks about hearing something, let's try and trace it back to see what we can find. Well, the first thing that you can't miss, anybody reading Bible, Chumash, can't miss, is the fact that the first effort, the first power of creation was speech. It doesn't say that Hashem made something with his head. The Torah could have spoken in any way. It could have said that God willed the world into existence. It could have said that he fashioned it with his head. In many ways, the Torah could have metaphorically expressed the fact that Hashem created the world. But it doesn't say any of those. It says he spoke. It's a fascinating idea. That means the world was formed by Hashem saying the words which became the object. Now, that's a tremendous misunderstanding to think that it means he gave instructions. That isn't what it means. When it says, Vayomer Elohim, and God said, it does not mean he said to the angels, please go and do such and such, not let there be light. It doesn't mean that he gave an instruction to the light department to go and put together that concept called light. It doesn't mean that at all. It means much, much, much deeper than that. It's unbelievable. It's incredible. Literally. To get that, it's impossible to grasp what it really means, but the words are something like this. When he said, let there be, that means when he said the thing, that was his creation. That's something we can't really grasp, because in our end of the spectrum, when we say something, it doesn't create the thing, at least that's what we think. When we say something, it's just a description, or at best an instruction for some physical agent to do something. But in the spiritual world, the word is the thing. When Hashem said a word, that concretized into the object. When God wanted to create light, he said "Or," and his word became and is the thing. We have to get into this mode of thinking in order to understand anything in the spiritual world. Monday night's supposed to be mystical night, so you presumably you're here because you, I don't know, you read the address or something, or you think it's a Kabbalah, but it means you have some interest probably in the higher dimension, so we try to understand things from their roots as best we're able. And it has to be understood that way, that the creation of something in the world is that the word is the thing. Let's try and feel this out a little bit. First of all, you see, English doesn't give you any of this, so we have this tremendous problem that we use words that have only the connotations that we've laid on top of the words. We don't understand the root concept in the word. But in Hebrew, by the way, I'm not saying one should speak Hebrew. It's a deep tradition we have that a person should not speak Hebrew. The Jewish nation has never used Hebrew as a spoken language in order to maintain those words potent in their spiritual meaning. That's why we always use another language, even if we had to make one up, like Yiddish. It's a big mistake that this generation uses Hebrew as a spoken language. It's another subject. Mm-hmm. Since we're on the subject of speaking. But the word itself, if you remain sensitive to it, will tell you exactly what it means. When it says the word speech, the word to speak, not or a word in Hebrew, davar, not the root in Hebrew is davar. That means a word. And diber means, or medaber, that root is means to speak. But the fascinating thing about that root is that the root of that root does not mean to speak. It means to act or to do or to create. There are many, many Torah sources for that. Like it says, Vayadber Amim Tachtani, he will control nations under us. Right? Or it says, Dabar Echad Lador, there is one activator of a generation, one man who rules or activates a generation. It's a word that means what in Hebrew called Hanhaga, that means conduct and control. That's what the word means. It's a word of creation. That's the first step. The second step, which is also in its ramifications, is staggering. The fact that the word in Hebrew for a word is the same word as the word for an object. That means any concept or entity or object in the world that in Hebrew is called a davar. But the word for a word is also davar. Now, you know, we understand that Hashem had as many words at his disposal as he needed. In fact, with the given letters of the Aleph Beis, there's many, 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 many more words that could have been constructed than what we have. He didn't run out of words. A person shouldn't think that he used a word for a word and the same word for an object because he couldn't think up any new combinations of letters. It doesn't take much to understand that there's a fault. It means that he called those two things by the same name because they are the same thing. It has to be that way, which is amazing. It means that when you consider an object in the world and you hear a word, it's actually the same thing. Where the two meet, if you trace them back to the root, is that when Hashem says a word, the object appears. That's the ultimate form of speech. The ultimate form of speech which humans will arrive at one day is the kind of speech where when you say something, the other person actually lives the thing that you say. You see, today's speech is so shattered that the best we can do when you want to convey something to someone is you start talking about the thing. You can never say the thing. So you start using words to sort of talk around it until eventually you sort of eliminate so many avenues that he sort of vaguely gets the idea of what you mean. Actually, he doesn't get the idea of what you mean. All that happens is he gets the idea of what he thinks you mean, which is really what he means. He doesn't really understand what you're saying. That's how communication goes. He just links into a picture that he has in his mind. That's how it goes. And that's why these days, if you trace it, you'll find that when a person says something, if you go to a shiur, a Rebbe says something, two Talmidim listen to a Rebbe says something, or somebody says something, the person who hears him goes out and says exactly the opposite. He says he said, and he says exactly the opposite. And the third person is told a different sugya, different subject entirely. Now, issue's been lost completely. That's a bitter fact, but that's the way communication is these days. You can test it out easily for yourself. Ask two people who heard the same shiur what the subject was, you won't even get the same subject of the shiur, never mind the same thing. When the world was created, it wasn't that way. Real speech, what's called Lashon Kodesh, the real tongue in the world, is a tool by which, when something is said in that language, when you hear it, you are the thing. That means that that language says the thing itself. It doesn't describe it or talk about it. The thing appears in the world. Because the word is the object. The Torah is teaching this when it says that Hashem created all objects in the world by saying the word. Are you with me? Now, let's try and understand that a little more deeply. There are many, many things that come out of it. The first thing that comes out of it is as follows. If he's speaking, somebody has to be listening. But the Jewish concept of the creation is that it's a conversation. That's our concept of the Bria. We understand this is a world in which we are. We understand that this world is a conversation with us. That there's somebody speaking, and we're supposed to be listening. Nobody speaks unless somebody's listening. When the Torah says in Bereshit that Hashem said this object, and he said that object, he said it into being. He was only saying it into being because there would be an ear which would hear that, into which that object would go. You with me? Nobody. That's the mystical concept of the creation, is that it was an expression of Hashem's essence which the beings in creation are supposed to receive. What we're supposed to absorb from the creation is the creation itself. We're supposed to absorb that emanation of his being and understand what he's saying, which means understand him, which means have him inside of us. That's what it means. We're trying to understand this more deeply as we go. So now, that's fact number two. It means, again, when the Torah says in Bereishis that Hashem said a certain thing, we understand that he began a conversation. And any object that he created, you could translate as being a word that he said. If you follow in English, you have to translate it. In Hebrew, it's the same thing. You don't have to translate. You've said both of them at the same time. He said because he wanted a listener to hear. This leads us to part of the depth of understanding of the tragedy and sin of this generation is that nobody's listening. Instead of hearing it as a conversation, we think it's a self-contained thing, that we can do what we want with it. Instead of understanding, right, somebody sends you a love letter. Imagine the person closest to you in your life sends you a letter of love. You take the letter and you treat it like a piece of paper. You use it for the needs of the bathroom. That's what we do to the world. We don't understand everything that we hear as a word from another place. We, instead of reading the letter, we take it and we use it for what we want. We think that it's a beginning and end in itself. We don't read what it says. That's what this generation is doing, no question about it. But the concept of the creation is that it's a letter. It's a book. It's one of the deepest Kabbalistic writings, the Sefer Yetzirah, which was written by Avraham Avinu. It says that the creation is called Sefer V'Sipur. That's what it says. That the creation is called a book and a story. I'm not going through. Sipur is the same word as a sefer. And the word sefer, which means a book in Hebrew, means lestater, it means to say. It means that the creation, again, same thing. The creation is a story that somebody's telling you, but we're not listening. We're using the book to swat flies instead of reading it. At best. Now, that means we have to develop this faculty of being able to hear things. Now, that's a conversation. We tried to explain once before, and we'll use the same example again. Perhaps you can see it from a new angle now. There are many points in Jewish life where you see this idea very clearly. For example, the effort of being Jewish is to take an object in the world, any object, any part of the body, any aspect of a relationship, anything in the world, anything, and to hear what it's saying. How do you hear what it's saying? You trace it back to the source. Right? When you read a letter that expresses love for you, the letter is just a medium. What you want to do with it is go back into the mind and heart of the person who sent it to you. That's where the relationship is. That's where the love is. So, we have an effort to listen to what's being said and trace it back to the source that it comes from. An example we gave before, and it's a beautiful thing, is, if you think about it, the whole of Jewish life is making a bracha, making blessings. We discussed this before. When you make a bracha, when you make a blessing, what you're doing is, it's very, very essential, critical to understand this. It's one of the areas, again, that the secular world
the Jewish sense of the word, has perverted into the exact opposite. What you're doing when you make a blessing is the following thing. You are saying, you see, the misconception is when you say Baruch Atah Hashem, blessed are you. That's what the words mean. So people think it means that you're giving God a blessing. You are blessed. It means I am now bestowing. You know, we turn things around now. Now I'm giving you, that's what it means, right? That's a blessing. You're going to stand up and make a bracha. It means I'm now going to convey a blessing. I mean, that's embarrassingly perverted to think that way. And that's the way we think. That's not what the words mean. The word Baruch in Hebrew means quite clearly, the Mephoshim also, Baruch means you are the source of bracha. That's what it means. When you say Baruch Atah Hashem, right? What you're actually saying is you, Hashem, are the source of bracha. Right? Elokeinu Melech Ha'olam, that's what you mean. You say you're the king of the world. That's exactly, Elokeinu means the one who does, the aspect, the manifestation of the divine that does and creates. Melech Ha'olam, the king of the world. There's no question. What you're doing, you're tracing this thing back to its source. That's what it means. That's chat in a bracha. So let's understand further. It means this. You take an apple. When you make a blessing on an apple, right, you're not saying, I now bestow a blessing on God for giving me this apple, or thanks for this apple. Thanks is contained in it, but only partly. The essence of what you're doing is you're saying, this apple is not an apple. This apple is a word of Hashem. It's an object in the world. Every object in the world is a word that He speaks. And therefore, this object is your word. So you say, Baruch Atah Hashem means, you are the source of this object. You're tracing a thing back to its source. That's what you're doing. Why do you have to do that? Because an apple doesn't look like a word of Hashem. An apple looks like an apple. That's the problem with an apple. It looks like an apple, but it's not. It's a direct word that He's... It's an incredible thing that He's saying to you with an apple. You know what an apple says to you? It says a world. And it's an amazing thing, an apple. And we're not going to go into the whole thing now. But if you think about it for a minute, you'll see it's the most amazing thing. What it's tapped into that apple. That would take technology. I don't know if they could do it. I don't know if the whole technological, high-tech, modern culture could pack into an apple what we're going to show them packed into an apple. The packaging, just think of the packaging that keeps them. I mean, there's fantastic things to an apple. Amazing things. It tastes good as well. Not only does it do what it's supposed to do for you, right from fixing your teeth all the way down to fixing your colon, right, with its wrappage. Fixes you up all the way down, an apple. Drink, and it tastes good as well. It's a fascinating thing. And it's an apple is specially organized so that when it's not ripe, it looks green. So you don't see it among the trees because it wouldn't be good to eat them. And as soon as it gets ripe, it turns red. That's not bad. That's very, very crafty packaging. That's a package that changes color when the others are very, very cunning. You don't understand that. We think an apple's an apple, but it's not. It's, and not only that, but inside that apple is a little seed that's got the potential to make more trees which could make more apples which could, to infinity. That's very, very clever. That means, probably if you had a well enough organized lab, you could probably make something that looks like an apple and tastes like an apple, but it wouldn't have baby apples, that's for sure. It for sure wouldn't be able to have trees which had apples. That's very, very clever. When a person looks at something like that, that's ruthlessly cruel, right, and ungrateful to think that what you're holding is an apple. What you're holding is no less than an incredible expression of power from the Creator. There's much more to it, but that's part of it. So therefore what you do is you make the effort of tracing it back to its source. You say, Baruch Atah Hashem, you are the source of this thing. But we have to do that to ourselves because we don't see it otherwise. And we'll try and explain why. So again, what have we understood? What have we built up here? We understand that the creation is somebody speaking. He's only speaking because we're supposed to be listening. We're supposed to be hearing what he's saying. And a bracha is an effort where you put yourself into the mode of hearing. Because you're usually in such a rush that you don't hear anything at all. We're in such a rush that not only don't we hear apples speaking to us, we don't hear people who are close to us when they're crying in need. People who are very close to us need a word of tenderness sometimes. Or some aspect, some little degree of sensitivity where we're much too much of a hurry to hear that. So we train ourselves not to hear anything. And you see what's going on. It's a world of tremendous cruelty and atrocity. There's no question about it. Nobody stops to listen to anything. So the effort of a Jew is to take every detail of the world and hear carefully what it's saying with tremendous sensitivity. Now, let's look at the next step. This idea of speaking of a language, words that are being put out into the world in the form of the creation, and we are hearing them, we understand something like this. Now, is a very difficult thing to grasp, because we're so far down the end of the scale that we don't have any place of contact. We don't make contact with this thing, but we can hear the words. And the words are something like this. When the world started out, so the language was so powerful that there was no way to misunderstand. We can't express that except perhaps by saying that when you hear Lashon Kodesh, if it would be possible to hear something said in that language, there'd be no possibility of misunderstanding. Because you would it's for example the difference between somebody trying to describe an object to you and somebody actually presenting that object so that you actually make contact with it. The difference, I mean, to give a very, very crude example, would be we're in a phase where somebody comes along and tells us that he once tasted a certain thing that you've never tasted, and he wants to try and explain to you what it tastes like. But there's no way, even the most articulate individual on earth, with all the words at his disposal, could never begin to convey to you anything of the taste of that thing. The only way you can even begin is by trying to tell you that it's like something which you actually already know tastes like. So you can use your own experience to imagine, but there's no way he can convey to you the taste of that thing. Imagine you tasted something that didn't taste like anything else at all. Not similar in any way to anything. Now you want to tell your friend what that thing tastes like. You can't even begin. There's no way, and that's a common experience. The taste of something, that's a tangible experience. But there's no way that communication, Lashon Kodesh means that what you say to the person, you do something that puts the taste into his mouth. The way the world was created was such that an object, if you heard it, you actually experienced the object. There was no possibility of misunderstanding. It didn't depend on communication. The communication was the thing. The speaker and the object and the listener were all one thing. That's, by the way, a deep secret which you won't go into now. Which why it says, Kuchabrihu, Oyraisa, and Yisrael, Chadhai. The Creator, the Jewish people, and the Torah, all one thing. Amazing thing. Amazing thing. That's a real conversation. Now, so the history of this idea is as follows. When the world was created, that's the way speech was, and all humans experienced it. When Adam Arishon was created, Adam, he spoke directly, that means he heard, experienced directly, but mustn't use our stereotypes that we built up. We think there was a man running around in the garden, didn't have any clothes on, never, and he sort of heard a voice, you know, this sort of voice was probably very big and it was kind of booming, and he heard this voice and it told him things, but that's not at all what happened. That was a man who actually internalized, that means he actually experienced every aspect of the creation. The point of contact was the ultimate experience in marriage. It was the ultimate marriage between two parties. There was an intimate experience where the speaker and the listener and the word were all one thing. We can't begin to understand what this means. Now, after Adam HaRishon, even after the fall, even after he sinned and he left the garden, but that was the language of the world. That means that was the language of the world. People spoke to each other like that. When one human being said something to another human being, there was no possibility of misunderstanding. There was absolute and perfect and total communication. Now, when did that end? We're trying to trace where we are. That ended at a tremendous, amazing experience called the Tower of Babel. Not the Tower of Babel. You know the Bible story? These people were trying to build a tower. I mean, the perverted version of it that was given to us. You know, they try to build a very tall tower and reach God and then sort of wrest control away from him. And they all spoke one language. That's what it says. Varim Achadim, it says. They all spoke one language. And then because they were getting too close to the source, and they were beginning to tamper dangerously close to the source of the outflow of power, as it says in the mystical writing. So there was danger that they were going to tamper with the fundamentals of the way the world works. So God came down, it says, Hashem came down, and he messed up their language. He fragmented their language. That's what it says. And then they couldn't speak to each other anymore, because language wasn't the potent tool that it had been before. This time you could listen to somebody and misunderstand what he was saying. And if you can't understand somebody, you can't build a tower. Not because it's... So the way they teach it to kids in Cheder, they say, you know, what happened was that the whole world spoke Hebrew, Lashon Kodesh. They all spoke Hebrew. It's true, by the way. You must understand that the perversions always are true. The words are always true. It's not like someone taking things and saying the opposite. The words are true, but they mean exactly the opposite. This is the way the Cheder teacher teaches to the children. She says to them, all the people there spoke Hebrew, and they understood each other perfectly. But then God came down and he made the one speak Zulu and the one speak Japanese. That's how it happened. So when the man speaking Zulu asked for a hammer, the man who spoke Japanese gave him a brick, so they couldn't build the building. And that's what happened, so they had to stop. The tragedies is quite true. That's where Zulu came from. That's where the languages, the 70 languages of the world, that's where they came from. They fragmented off from Hebrew. They split off from the one source of language, which was Lashon Kodesh, which was Hebrew. That's the superficial understanding. It's quite correct. If you have any experience in this field, you'll know that there's a lot of work being done recently. We're not going to go into the super. We're going to try and maintain our look at the deeper level. But if you're interested in this, as an aside, you can look at it sometime. There's a lot of work being done recently tracing languages of the world back to Hebrew roots. I don't know if you know that. You know that there was a big misconception foisted on the academic world that language developed spontaneously. You know, since we're evolutionary creatures, after we finished being gorillas, so we started grunting to each other in sort of more meaningful kind of ways. That's what they say. So the gorillas in sort of Eastern Europe, they developed this what they call the Indo-European root. That was a system of grunts that kind of became later. I don't know why you're laughing. This is what it says in the best textbooks. I'm not making it up, I assure you. That's how language originated, and that's what formed the Indo-European root, and there was other roots, three or four major Asiatic and European roots that became modern versions of language. That's what they teach. But it's not correct at all. We weren't ever gorillas. Some of us might be heading that way, but it's not it's not how the world started. We understand that the original language was Hebrew in its pristine and perfect form, and it split up into versions of Hebrew which became the 70 root languages of the world. There's fascinating work today which traces back its origins. The book just been published in the United States, I believe it's called The Word, by somebody called Moseson, consists of, somebody told me, 80,000 English words traced back directly to Hebrew root, right? Which is one, the complete approval of the people, one of the major etymologists in this field who works on language derivation, writes the preface there that you have to rethink the whole theory of language, of generation of language. It's, by the way, it's obvious. If you have any experience with English and Hebrew, there's so many words that are so obviously based on Hebrew. We're not going to go into that. We have time afterwards, we can discuss it. And other languages, a certain rabbi I know who's interested in this field told me that recently somebody published a dictionary of 2,000 Japanese words directly derived from Hebrew. It's well known that Sanskrit not only takes Hebrew words, but actually conveys the spiritual depth of the Hebrew words. Very interesting. The mantras that the Easterns use. The Eastern mantras are fragments of God's Hebrew name. Very often we're not allowed to use them, sometimes we are. There's no question that it all traces itself back here. But tonight's not, let's stick to the more, to the deeper side. That's interesting subject. But what the story means is this. Whether Hebrew became Zulu is not the point. It did, but that's not the point. The point is that there was a language, never mind Hebrew, there was a language that when one person expressed something, another one experienced exactly what he said. When that became fragmented, what it means is that the ability to communicate, the consistency between the inner world and the outer world became so fractured that no longer what you meant inside is what was represented outside. That's what it is. So somebody listening to you wouldn't get what you meant inside, and there's no way you could convey it to him. So a listener now in the new world, after that breakdown, a person could say something, and the listener might as well be hearing Zulu. The point that the language isn't, but the point is that the tragedy is that when you speak the same language today, the person hears the opposite. Now, it doesn't take any intelligence to see that. So that's exactly what happened. And if you're trying to build a tower, it wasn't a tower. It was an edifice of spiritual greatness. It was a creation that went to the heart of existence. You see, what that keeps the kids is also a tremendous problem. In one place it says it was a spaceship. It says it was a spaceship, not a tower. The Edison Arishitz, I believe, says that. But the concept, again, he also doesn't mean a spaceship like that. What's meant is something very high, but spiritually high. It's not a concept that they built a tower so high. You think of that level of creation where people could speak a language that God spoke, you think they thought that if they built a building high enough, they would reach. But they knew that. They knew a lot more than we know. They were trying to build something that went to the root of power, not something that went to the sky. Only when you teach a six-year-old, you can't tell him that. So you have to say a tower that went to the... But if you stick at a six-year-old level, there's a tremendous tragedy. They were trying to build it. In the Mephoshim, it says that what they were trying to build, if you really want to know, it says they were trying to build, it says, Ir Umigdal, a city and a tower. That's what it says. Which is exactly Jerusalem and the Beit HaMikdash. That's what it is. There's sources in Chazal that say the Beit HaMikdash is called Umigdal, in Shir HaShirim, and an Ir, the city, is the city, Yerushalayim. Why? Because Yerushalayim is the place on earth where the outer world meets the inner world. It's where the lower world meets the higher world. That's what Jerusalem is, in case you thought it was just a town. Yerushalayim and the Beit HaMikdash is the place where the upper and the lower worlds meet each other. Mount Sion, that mountain where the root of the world is the place, it's the physical manifestation of where the external lower world meets its source. That's why it says in Chazal that that spot on earth is the place the Shmaya Va'ara Nashbi Adadi, that heaven and earth kiss each other. That's what it says. Heaven and earth kiss. That's what it means. Heaven means the spiritual dimension, doesn't mean the sky. And earth means the spiritual dimension. And kissing is an expression of tremendously deep communication. Kissing, you know, that is not, in the mystical writing, not easy to talk about. But the connection between humans that produces children in the higher world is called kissing. I don't know if you're aware of that. It's a tremendously intimate experience where there's a meeting between two creative forces. That's what it means. That's why, we haven't got time, but that's why it's done with a mouth. Because speaking, which is what we tried to explain last night, which is the thing where the one world becomes the other world, the inner world is manifest in the outer world, where one person connects with another, that's done with a mouth. But a kiss is the same thing. Also eating is the same, because eating connects the body with the neshama, but we won't go into that now. It's also done with the same organ. No accident. Hashem could have thought of more than one mouth. In fact, there's a suggestion in the Gemara. Somebody said that, why didn't he make two mouths, one for speaking, one for eating? Says that in the Gemara. So somebody said we've got enough trouble with one. We make enough of a mess. Anyone says that? And we make enough mess with one mouth, didn't want to give us two. But it's much deeper. What's meant is, and it doesn't take long to realize that kissing connects to this mystical depth, and that is because, if you think about it, as we've often pointed out, it's a very silly thing to do. Where did this idea come from, kissing? People kiss each other. You know, that's not a, that's a universal experience. All cultures on earth, right? It's a natural human experience. It's not, why didn't people rub ears together? Why didn't they rub their ears or grind elbows or something? Why? That's a very, very deep question. Where did this, anybody thinks it's accidental? If you think that there were two gorillas who bumped into each other by their mouths one day and it's kind of, they liked it, you know, that's not, that's the, that is the way they talk in the academic world. But anybody with any sensitivity knows it's got nothing to do with that. It's a tremendously deep expression of connection. Tremendously deep. And that's why, because if you think about it really, there's much more pleasant ways to have connection between individuals. It's probably much more pleasant to rub your cheek against somebody else. You know, kissing is messy. And it's unhealthy also. It's unhealthy. I mean, who would come up with such an idea? You might think it's humorous, but it's not. It goes to the root of the issue. Anyway, anyone with any sensibility understands that there's something intrinsic in it. There's something very intrinsic in this thing, and that's how we do it. Now, that's how the world was. There was a level of communication where the word was the thing that you understood. Then it says that because of human misconduct, language was broken down. And no longer was what you were trying to express from the inside, an accurate reflection of you, understood by somebody else. The gap was too great, and that wasn't allowed anymore. What's a fascinating thing to know is that it says Neirda v'navla sham svasan. That's what it says in Rashi. Let us go down. When they started to build this structure, it was an attempt to get into the heart of the spiritual realm. Hashem destroyed it by saying Neirda, let us go down v'navla sham svasan, and let us mix up their language. The fascinating thing is that the word to mix up language in Hebrew is navla, which is bovel. The English word Babel, by the way. Babel. To make a Babel is base lamed. That's the Hebrew word Babel. Babel. Navla means to mess up their language. And where did it happen? In a country called Babel. It says that they built the tower in a land called Babel, which later became Babylon. Which Babel, that's what it was. Now, very interesting. The land was called because of the fact that that's where, that was the crucible, the place on earth, where language was melted down and fractured. That's a fascinating thing. So Hashem went down to that spot on earth and he broke down that purity of language in that place. We'll come back to it. Now, after that time, people couldn't understand each other anymore. There was one place on earth where that language remained. One tiny thread of a language that still retained that power, and that is called prophecy. Nevuah is the power to be able to speak Lashon Kodesh. When a Navi speaks, what does it say in the Mephoshim? It says that when a prophet speaks and you hear him, you don't have any doubt. When a person hears a prophet speak, you don't have any doubt. The prophet is not saying words to you that you take or leave. When a prophet speaks, you experience the thing itself. When a prophet says, Hashem said so and so, you have heard, you actually experienced, you could not withstand hearing the source itself. We think prophecy was a chap who walked up and down the street with a placard sort of announcing doom, but that's not what it was. He was a person who was able to, from his throat came a sound that shook you to the core. You actually experienced the thing itself. The man who did that was Abraham. Avraham Avinu was alive at the time of the fragmentation of language, and he was the one who refused to participate in this building, and when language fragmented, he was left with the Lashon Kodesh, and he passed it on to his children. And the language of purity continued in the world until when? There were more than a million prophets in the Jewish nation. More than a million prophets we had. Not all recorded. The only ones that are recorded are the ones that are needed for their time and for later. But it says more than a million prophets around. So there was a tremendous potency of this voice in the world. When the Torah was given, of course, we heard it directly ourselves. Where did that language end? Where did prophecy end? Where did prophecy end? Prophecy ended in Babel. Isn't that amazing? It says that the Jews were exiled because of another, a much lower form, right? Because we went wrong spiritually again, right? At a much lower point, we were exiled to Babel, the Babylonian exile. And in Babel, prophecy died. Because the great Sanhedrin, at that generation, they took prophecy and they expunged it, they removed it from the world, along with certain fragments of the human neshama, that's another area, but they removed prophecy from the world. Which means that from that time on, and the Gemara says clearly that there's no prophecy left. Anybody who comes along to tell you that God spoke to him and said this and this, we reject it out of hand, because we have a cloud that from the time of Ezra on, prophecy was closed in the world. No nevuah. The Gemara says only remains in a small way in three areas, and that is in children, in dogs, and in mad people. That's what the Gemara says. Prophecy resides now only in those three places, and it brings proofs of how it is. But that's another area. But prophecy, that we understand what a prophet is, a Navi, we don't have any more in the world. It happened again in Babel, the same place that language broke down the first time. And it says in Mephoshim, it says in Midrash, in Chazal, it says, like a man sends his wife back to her father's house. The divorce, the relationship becomes so bad that they go through a divorce, and he sends her back to her father's house. That's what it says. Hashem divorced us, and he sent us back to the place where we were formed. Where were we formed? In Babel. Ur Kasdim was the name where Abraham grew up, where Abraham became the great man that he became, and heard the voice. That's where we were born. That was the first man who began what we are. When we misbehaved, Hashem sent us back to the same place and finally smashed what he'd begun. That's why we were sent back to Babel, and that's why language broke down over there. Now, a beautiful aspect of this, to understand, is the fact that how do we fix this up? That's our problem. But that's the fact, that's the history. But how do we fix it up? How do we rehear? How do we hear that language again in the world? How do we do that? So it's a fascinating thing. The way we try and hear that language, where does a Jew try and hear that voice again? Where's the avenue? How do we try and hear again that voice of purity? That voice that's a direct call from the source, Torah. We learn Torah, right? We try to take Torah into it. Well, Torah is that word. Torah is the Dvar Hashem. That's Hashem speaking. It's hidden and you have to uncover it, but that's where it is. So in order to hear that voice again, we try and take Torah and we try and hear it. And how do we do it? Talmud. Torah Shebaal Peh. And the whole effort of Jews since that generation has been learning Gemara, learning Talmud. And you know what it's called? Talmud Bavli. We learn Talmud Bavli. We learn the Talmud. It comes out of Babel. It's a fascinating thing. You know, we have another Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud. There's a Talmud Yerushalmi, but that's not what we do. We don't engage ourselves with Talmud Yerushalmi. We engage our minds with the Talmud Bavli. The Talmud Bavli is one long book of fragmentation. Talmud Bavli, anybody who's had the faintest exposure to Gemara will know that it's a broken down thing from beginning to end. Nothing fits. When you start learning a page of Gemara, it doesn't work like mathematics, that one and one is two, and then the next thing, that's not Gemara. You start with something in the Gemara, just as you understand it, the Gemara smashes it, and it falls to pieces. And you try to reconstruct the pieces another way. And after you finally think you've reconstructed them, the Gemara shatters it again. And again, and again, and then it breaks the pieces down, then it breaks those pieces down. Until finally you reconstruct something very deep that you understand. That's Talmud Bavli. The only way we can piece together the original unity, the original purity, is by working in the darkness. We take the broken pieces, and it's all we have. That's all we have to use. We don't have a Navi now to come and tell us the thing like it is. So we take the fragments, and by putting the fragments together inside ourselves, right? The only way Gemara happens is inside you. When you learn Gemara, the better your Rebbe is, the clearer your Rebbe tells you what the Gemara means, the less you get out of it. the more clearly the Rebbe puts the Sugya and the Gemara together, the less benefit you have. Because the only benefit of Talmud is the agony you go through in trying to put the pieces together. That's how you grow in Talmud. In all other areas it's not so. In all other areas of Torah, when you hear a thing, it's beautiful.
The Kabbalistic wisdom, for example. Not to say anybody sweats to understand it. When the Arizal used to learn his Kabbalistic teaching, do you know what he was doing most of the time? Thinking. It says that in one night, he learned more. He once told one of his Talmudim that what they just taught me, a Talmud Rajim, Talmud bent over to hear his lips. The Arizal's lips were moving up. One of his Talmudim, of his inner circle, leant over to catch a word. And as he said that, the Arizal smiled and he opened his eyes. He said, what they just told me, he said, Rebbe, what were you saying? What were you learning? He said, what they just told me will take me more than 80 years to begin to explain to you. And he was talking to somebody in the inner circle of the Arizal, not talking to you or me, talking to somebody who already had 80 years behind him of what it takes. So it doesn't say he sweat, but it says when the Ari used to learn Gemara, he used to shake and sweat. When he used to learn Talmud, he used to shake visibly and sweat. Because Gemara is only effort, by the way, it's an important prize. Many people who start learning Talmud, they really try, they want to become spiritually great. This is the process I'll describe it. They go to the shul, this is what happens. They hear somebody who impresses them very much, all these mystical, fantastic ideas. The next thing is the decision, they're going to be a tzaddik and a kubal. Then what happens? Then they ask, how am I going to do this? They go to the Rebbe. Where can I learn? The Rebbe says, you've got to learn Gemara. That's all. The result, before he became a great kubal, he learned Gemara. Nobody does it by, you don't go to a crash course in there, you know, these people in the spiritual Star Wars and books that they put out, you know, that you learn it. They don't do that. You've got a book from the beginning, you learn Gemara. So the person goes to Yeshiva and he can't stand it because it's agonized. So the usual response is, this is not for me. I'm not talented at this field. There are other people who are talented there. He looks around and he sees the people who know how to learn. It's a common experience in Yeshiva. He looks around at the experts, chapter in follow for 30 years where he's Rosh Yeshiva. He glides through the Gemara like it is nothing. He says, well, look, he's very talented. Obviously, I'm not talented at it. It's a terrible mistake. Terrible mistake. Nobody's talented at Gemara. Gemara is designed to be difficult for everybody. The more gifted you are, the more you have to seek a new level below that level where you're having difficulty. Everybody's effort in Gemara is to go down to a level where you struggle. If you're reading it at a level where it's meaningful, where it's easy, where it goes, you're not growing. The whole experience of Talmud is to descend to a level where you can't understand the thing and then reconstruct it. Because then you reconstruct yourself. That's the effort of Talmud. That's what it is. People understand that. That's why it's called Babylon. Not only does it mean it came out of Babylon, it means it's in a deeper sense. That it comes out of the fractured world. It's the only way. You look at the world, the world doesn't speak to you without a sense. It doesn't show you spiritual things. You've got to reconstruct it. You've got to learn how to pierce the sense. This is not a world that speaks openly. We don't live in such a generation. None of the prophets are shut up. You've got to take the world, look beneath the surface, and reconstruct it and see the everything. Now let's look more deeply at this idea. And I'll show you something that's fascinating on this. And we'll leave it to the end of this day. The idea is as follows. When we try and reconstruct these fragments and put them together and hear that voice, the idea to grasp is something like this. What is here? Now we're going to go deeper now. Try and stay with me and try and use the faculty that you've been trying to develop. What is here? What's the ability to hear something? It's always explained that the whole theme of mystical wisdom is to look at the world and to see the way the world works physically. From understanding how the world works physically, we filter it through that abstract filter, right, into the hidden part of the mind and understand without words how the spiritual world works. You know what I mean? That's the first thing we try to explain many times. The spiritual world is an exact replica, or rather, the physical world is an exact replica of the spiritual world. But only you can't see into the spiritual world. So to get an understanding of what it is, we study the physical, very, very, very minutely, and we deal with the physical, that's what Torah does, but from there we understand what the spiritual world looks like if you translate the physical material into spiritual shape. You follow? But it matches it exactly, and I'll try to say many times just an example. So let's do that exercise. Let's look at what hearing is.
The way the sugya is usually expressed is by contrasting the faculty of seeing with the faculty of hearing. That means when you see something, you have one experience. When you hear something, it's a different experience. The only way I know how to try and get it across is to try and see how these two modalities differ
perhaps to, you see, in the mystical sources it says something like the fact that seeing is the higher world and hearing is the lower world. That's why in the mystical structure of the human, the eyes are on top. The eyes are the highest point, because they see a thing as it is. The next down in the structure is the ears, because the ears are more in the world of darkness. Now let's try and understand that. So let's look at it physically. Physically now, when you look at something and when you hear something, if you think about it carefully, you don't have to be a mystic for this. You just have to look objectively at the world. When you see something and when you hear something, you will immediately be aware that those two things work exactly opposite to each other. It's a fascinating thing. For example, when you look at something, what you see is exactly what there is. The scene is apparent to you all at once. When you look at a scene, all details that make up the scene, all its aspects and details, its colors, its spots, are all there at once. That's a perception of the whole all at once. So when you look at something, the experience is what the mystics call outside of you. It's in the scene. It doesn't take place in you. Be careful now. We're talking conceptually now. Because what you reflect in you when you see the scene is exactly the way the scene is outside. If what's there is presented to you and you see it. It doesn't take any interpretation. You don't have to start doing any exercise. What's there is what you see. When you hear, it's exactly the opposite. When you hear something, the details never come together. When you hear something, when somebody speaks to you, he has to say one syllable, then the next, then the next, then the next, then the next, then the next. And by the time he says syllable number two, syllable number one is not in the world anymore. By the time he says word number one, and you hear word number one, that doesn't mean anything to you. Then he says word number two. While your brain is taking in word two, word one isn't around. It's not in the world anymore, and word three hasn't come into being yet. But word one is a memory inside of you. When he goes on to word number three, or syllable number three, word two has disappeared from the world, but it's a memory. But still you haven't got any meaning, because the first three words of a long sentence aren't meaningful yet. So what happens is you take in the information on trust. You take it into a place, a pool of knowledge, that doesn't have any shape yet. Are you with me? When he finally gets to the end of his sentence, and the last word goes in, and there's nothing left in the world, you put it all together. So the experience of hearing happens in you, not outside of you. You with me? It's the opposite process, the mystic says. You hear one thing at a time. You can't hear it all together. If you try to see speaking, how would you see speaking? If the person could say it all at once. Let's say the person would say to you all the sounds in that sentence all at once. You just hear a noise. You wouldn't hear anything. The only way you can hear is if it comes in logical order and not together. Are you with me? That means when somebody wants to say something, they can never say the whole thing. They can never present it to you. They can't show it to you. You can't show something somebody's mouth. You can't, you follow. You can only, which means this. Here comes the crutch. The crutch. The faculty of hearing is the ability to put things together. Shema, the Hebrew concept of hearing, is the mystical, if you translate it, let's do the translation now. We looked at the physical world, right? Seeing something. Re'iya, what's called re'iya, seeing a thing, you see it as it is. Shmi'a, hearing a thing, you don't see it as it is. You see it as it is inside of you, but only the way you reconstruct it. And you never see it the way it is, because the thing never is. It's one sound, and then another sound, and another, that's ridiculous. Doesn't have any cohesiveness. But it's only you who put it together. Are you with me? Let's do the translation now. And by the way, that's why, that's exactly why in Hebrew, the word for seeing a thing is re'iyah. The word for proving something in Hebrew is re'ayah, the same word. Because seeing is believing. When you want to prove a thing to somebody, you show him. If you show him black and white, nothing you can say. Re'iyah is a re'ayah. When you want to prove something to somebody, you show it to him. But if you explain it to him, that's not a proof. Because that depends on how he's going to hear it. You want to explain something to somebody, you can't prove it. You say the thing, and you say it and say it and say it, but then it's over to him. If he does accept what you're saying, it's only because he puts it together that way. You follow, but he doesn't. It's a very, very beautiful idea. That is why, for those who've had an insight into Gemara, you'll be very, very, it's amazing to know. That is why all higher writing, all the deeper wisdom, the higher writing, always talks about seeing. That the work, the Torah writing that's on the lower level where you do the work, it talks about hearing. For example, Tashma. When the Gemara wants you to understand something, the Gemara says, Tashma, come in here. You have to put those words in, it's going to tell you. But first it says, Tashma, come in here. There's no extra words in the Gemara. It wants you to come and listen. It's Tashma. Didn't we have Tashma in the Sugya a few times? Come and listen. Let's try this. Let's listen to this. But it means you've got to try. You put it together. Tashma, come in here. But in the Zohar and in the Talmud Yerushalmi, it doesn't say Tashma. It's Tachazi. Come and see. Isn't that beautiful? Do you know that? You look in Zohar, it doesn't say Tashma. The deep mystical writing. I don't know, you never jump up and down with excitement. I don't know why. It's worth jumping up and down, I can assure you. It's very, very fascinating. But in the Zohar and in the Talmud Yerushalmi, when it wants to explain something to you, it says, Tachazi, come and see, because you don't have to put anything together. It shows that you're openly over there. And that's why it says, the Kabbalistic wisdom, they say about it, Ha-emes eid la'atzmo. Ha-emes eid la'atzmo. The truth is a witness to itself. It doesn't take any proving. When you're exposed to these things in their deep emes, the way they really are, you don't have to hear anything, you don't have to prove anything. The thing is what it is, it doesn't take any proof. Tashma is not that. Gemara is not like that. The Gemara doesn't want to show it to you. And that's why the Gemara never puts it to you the way it is. The Gemara always puts it to you the wrong way first, and then another wrong way, and another wrong way, and another wrong way. Because it wants you to reconstruct out of the falsity, falsehood, it wants you to reconstruct the image. Because that's the training for dealing with the world. The way we're supposed to deal with the world, not supposed to walk out there and look at it the way it is. That's the opposite of what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to go and look at the world the way it's not exactly. Look beneath the surface. Yeah, if you look at the world the way it is, you think an apple's an apple. If you look at the world the way the Gemara looks at the world, you understand what an apple is, and you hear it speak to you. We explained once before also that that's the root behind the idea of why brachas were made when they were. You know that when prophecy ended, and that voice left the world, the same people who drove prophecy out of the world composed all the brachot, all the brachas. Isn't that amazing? The Anshayk Nesis Agdola, the ones who banished prophecy from the world, the ones who stilled that voice forever, they composed all the brachas. Which is amazing, because before that generation there were no brachas. Except for the one or two Doraita brachas, Birkas HaMazon, Benshu, which is Doraita from the Torah. And Birkas HaTorah, there were no brachas. When a person went to the bathroom, in times, before Anshayk Nesis, they didn't make any blessing. Today we make a bracha to use the bathroom. When a person ate an apple, or drank a glass of water, he didn't make any blessing. There was no formalized bracha. But today, after Anshayk Nesis Agdola, every single thing in Jewish life is a blessing. What isn't the bracha today? Waking up in the morning, going to sleep at night, using the bathroom, eating, anything you do in modern life, Jewish life is a bracha. What was responsible, we mentioned this before, what was responsible for that radical change? That means there was a generation where nothing was a blessing, and suddenly as prophecy ended, everything's a blessing. But anybody who has any insight well now will understand from what we've said tonight, that the two are intimately linked. You didn't need brothers before. When prophecy was around in the world glowed with its inner meaning. It was incandescent with its spiritual meaning. So when you looked at any aspect of the world, you saw the source. Nevuah, prophecy in the world, means a flourishing, a flowering, niv. Nib spasayim is what nevuah means. It means a welling up from a hidden world. So when prophets were in the world, you didn't need to acknowledge the source. You saw it directly. An apple looked like exactly what it was. So you didn't have to point out to yourself what it was. But after they killed prophecy, after they silenced that voice forever, and we no longer hear that voice from another world, so now you're in big danger of an apple looking like an apple. So now you have to do the work of putting in acknowledgement of the source. That's why we make prophets today. We try and put back that vision. We try and hear the voice that you can't hear anymore by our making the effort. You have to keep reminding yourself, this is from you, Hashem, this is from you, this is from you. This glass of water, this apple, this, everything from you is from you, and we put a broker in, but that's why we do it now. That's the idea of seeing and of hearing. Hearing is what happens in the darkness. Seeing happens in the light, it happens outside. Hearing the voice happens in the darkness. The message from this, the message is that being great in the spiritual world is not wandering through without thinking. It's all internal work. Nobody will ever show it to you. Those who want to have it demonstrated, like this generation wants everything served up exactly already, instant. Instant serving of everything, as you just add water and there it is. That's not, Torah's never that way. The only way Torah is if you take a Rebbe and you hound him for years and you sit on his doorstep and at times you just sleep under his bed until they were discovered and follow him into the bathroom. There was a, in the Gemara, there's a master where the Talmud, the Rebbe turned around and found a Talmud in the bathroom with him. He said, what are you doing here? The Talmud said, it's Torah, I've got to learn. It's not recommended, by the way. But there's a master in the Gemara where he found his Talmud under his bed. Because that's Torah. The way he behaves, what he does, exactly as he does it, that's the way, that's Torah. So a person, that's only the way it happens in you. you learn it and put it together and do it and understand it will never be shown outside, as opposed to this crazy world where they dish everything up in stereo, you know, whatever it's called, colour, and demonstrate it. Torah is private. It happens inside. And that's why we've said many times marriage is the place to learn that. That's why a woman has this ability. That's why the Torah is called a wife. Torah is called a woman. Because it's in the hidden domain. It's the one who guards modesty. She guards her privacy. That's what the Torah is. It says that you have to marry the Torah to discover its depth. Let's just look at one more aspect of this. We'll leave it at that. It says that this idea of hearing a thing as putting together, we said in the beginning, the rule was, we try and trace it back in Chumash. We try and find the first time it says that thing, try and find the root, and then we could understand it. Well, we have Shema Israel. Shema, hear. Hear, O Israel. That calls us to come and listen. That's where the Chumash says, Ta Shema. Come and listen to something. What happened? Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, was dying. And as he lay on his deathbed, his sons gathered, tribes, his sons gathered around him. So it says that he wanted to reveal to them the end of time. He wanted to reveal to them the final revelation. He wanted to tell them the world's big secret, the ultimate secret of the world, where the final end will be, what the revelation will look like, when it will come, exactly what it will be. So he said to them, it says, Bikesh legalos lehem es hakeis. He wanted to reveal to them the case, the revelation. And as he was about to reveal it, it was taken away from him. That revelation was torn out of his soul, and he couldn't say it. He wanted to give his children the strength to go through the darkness that's lasting till now. He wanted to give them the strength by knowing where they were heading. So in order to prepare them for the Golus, for the exile, he tried to speak out what would be the pathway that would lead to the redemption. But as he tried, it was taken away. So a cold fear gripped his heart because he thought that if he couldn't, he knew he was perfect. He knew that he had reached the level where that prophecy should have come out of him. And if it couldn't come out of him, the problem must be in the listeners. Because any speech in Torah is communication, like we said before, it's a conversation. It's not just an announcement. It's not just me speaking for my own, it's me speaking for you to hear. So revealing the secret to them was for them to hear it. And if he couldn't say it, it must be because they couldn't hear it. So he thought that one of them must have an imperfection. But he went around looking at their faces and he saw they were perfect. And we know that because he gave each one a brocha, focusing exactly on his spiritual greatness, on his whole constellation of spiritual forces. So he was left with the following problem. He was facing a group of people. He was aware, he was convinced, he thought there must be an imperfection in them, and he couldn't see the imperfection, because each one is perfect. So there's only one solution to that problem, and probably if you've had some Gemara background, you've already picked it up. If each one is perfect, and yet there's still an imperfection, the imperfection must be in their unity. So he thought that despite the fact that each one is perfect, but they don't form a bond, they don't form the Jewish people, those tribes which are going to form, that the Am Yisrael, they aren't bonded together yet into one human. They're 12 individual human beings. But since they haven't melted into each other's consciousness and formed one human, they can't hear the revelation. Because the Jews, you can only hear when you're together in yourself. That's why Torah was given. When Torah was given, it was only because all 3 million Jews camped at Sinai like one man, it says. They encamped there. Rashi says they encamped, and it uses the singular. Talking about 3 million people, and it uses the singular because they were all one. So then Torah could be given. If all the Jews melted into one being, so then the Torah could be given. That's the secret. It says, like Adam Rishon before the Chait. Adam Rishon before the Chait was one person, and they melted back into one superhuman. Then they could receive Torah. So when Yaakov Avinu wanted to give Torah to his children, and he couldn't give it, he reasoned that they must not be together. So they already thought. They knew immediately what the problem was. And they all said to him, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Shema Yisrael. Yisrael was his name. Yaakov Avinu was called Yisrael. They said, Shema Yisrael, listen, put it together. Shema, put it together. Just as he's one in your heart, says Rashi, he's one in ours. And then Yaakov realized that they were perfect each and perfect together, and it was a special act of Hashem that he wasn't to be allowed to reveal that end to them. And so therefore it was taken away from him. But the whole sugya that Shema is talking about is putting things together. That when you say Shema, it's not like an announcement, there's no sort of rhetorical statement in Torah. Shema Yisrael, you know, you're not making a big announcement, you say it loud so all of Israel can hear you. Shema Yisrael, that's what it means. Shema Yisrael means hear you, this one. Shema, put it together, that's what it means. Put the fragments together inside of you. Take the world that's all fragmented and you, that's also broken up into pieces, spiritually, and put it together inside of you. And then what happens? Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. At that moment when you say Echad, the Shema becomes Echad, the two words together form A, the two big letters form a witness, because now you're seeing the thing the way it is. Now you are suddenly seeing that which is said. You put it together. And that's why when you say the word Echad, you melt into the whole universe. When you say the last part of the word Echad, your consciousness is supposed to be that everything is just the oneness of Hashem. You're not supposed to think when you say the word Echad that there's only one God. You know that. We credit an intelligent 10-year-old with being able to figure out that God is such a kind of a thing that there can only be one of. There's no big deal in announcing that there's only one absolute. An absolute can only be one. We don't mean there's only one God. We mean much more than that. We mean that there's only one God, that there is nothing else. Not that there's no other God up there with him, but there's no me. There's no world. There's no you. There's no up. There's no down. It's just the oneness of Hashem. That's a very dangerous thought. That's why you only think it long enough to say the part of the second part of the word Echad. As you say Echad, you think only long enough, the Gemara says, only long enough to be aware that he's one up, down, and all sides, whatever that means. But as soon as you thought that, you stopped. Because in that moment, you didn't exist. At that moment, it was a meditation so deep that you don't exist as a separate human being. It says in the Gemara, there was a great Amora came in front of his Rebbe, and when they said Shema, he prolonged the word, and the Rebbe said, that's too long. He said, it was too long, you don't need that long. He wouldn't let him say the word Echad that long. The one said that in Bach. That's what Shema means. I'll tell you one more thing, but it'll take a long time, so meet the Shem next week. That's really the thing. Unless some of you, if anybody wants to stay, then I'll tell them, I don't want to keep those who want to leave. I'm not offended. I'll tell you this idea as well. You really do need this to complete the picture, so it's worth it. But it's very, this is not easy, but it's worth working on. We've understood now something about seeing and hearing. That there's a place in Torah where you have a tremendous conflict between these. An unbridgeable gap. And the explanation, the understanding of what's going on, is an acute and accurate insight into what we've been saying. You have the following thing. We've been talking now about speaking, about listening, about hearing, putting together, right? In the last 2 weeks, we hope to have some clarity on this idea. Some deeper clarity. Now it says that when Torah was given, when that incredible speech happened, when God spoke and we heard, in the ultimate sense, which we should understand by now a little bit differently, that doesn't mean that it means the real speech, the real language, and we heard it in such a way that we became one with it. It says that they saw the sounds. That's what it says. It says, Ra'u esakonos, that there were incredible sounds at Sinai when God spoke. The sound of the shofar. The sound, the noise, the incredible, mystical, magical noise that came out, which was not like any human sound, it says the people saw it. Amazing thing. What does that mean? You hear sound, and you see a sight. You don't hear sound. So in terms of what we've been saying, there are other ways to understand it, all correct. But, just this is one way, but let's try and put it into terms that we use this evening. You'll see it's the most fascinating idea. As follows. It should be off this background, it should be easy to understand. This world is a world that you can only hear. You can't see this world. You can only hear it. Because it's fragmented in every way. It's fragmented in its space dimension and it's fragmented in time. You don't experience the world all at once. You experience the world by moving through time, which by definition means you hear it. By the way, hearing doesn't have to be done with the ears, you understand? From everything we said tonight, you could hear with your eyes. It means, it depends how you, it's just a description of experience. You can hear it in many other ways. It's only that the example we have in the world is that it's done with the ears. And the example of how seeing is done in the world in its pure form is done with the eyes, if you're with me. But it's a way of experiencing. The way we experience the world is by hearing. Are you with me? The world is not an experience that instantaneously impinges on your consciousness in one infinite instant, and that's your life. Your life is an experience that you put together. It's one thing and then the next and then the next. Your image of the divine in the world is gained by how you go through life and experience it. That's called hearing. You understand the depth? There was one amazing statement. A great Mashgiach once told his Talmidim, that what they should do with their lives, they should write the Megillah.
We're coming up to Purim now.
Purim is the Megillah. Purim is the Megillah, right? The story. This happened and this and Esther and the king and Mordechai and so forth and so on, the whole story. He told his Talmidim they should sit down and write the Megillah of their life. Write down what happened. Take your life history and say, I went here, I went here, I did this, I did this, I did this, and write it out. What was he talking about? What's the idea? The idea is incredible. The idea is this. It's an amazing, amazing thing. The example that we have in Torah of looking at a hidden world and understanding its depth is the Megillah. The Megillah of Purim doesn't say anything openly. It's the one book of the Torah where God's name is not mentioned once. You know that? In the whole Megillah text that does not mention Hashem once. It's the one part of Torah where God's name isn't mentioned. The whole idea of the hidden world, of the spiritual world, is never mentioned once. The whole Megillah is just a story. It's just a political story. There was a king and there was a queen and she died and he married somebody else and two men tried to kill him and she discovered the plot and so forth and so on, and then the Jews were saved. But all about political events. Political human events. There's nothing magical, there's no miracles, there's no nothing. But when you read it all together, you see the miracles. When you read it all together and you see all the themes of the Megillah, and they all cross at one point, the Mephoshim say that all the themes, Esther's life, and the two plotted to kill the king, and Mordechai and the king, at one instant, one night when the king couldn't sleep, at that moment it all came together. He couldn't sleep, he called for the book. In the book he read about Mordechai. Mordechai was the news that he got from Esther. Haman arrived at the same time, he put the two together, and everything turned upside down. That means amazing themes in life all happened to crisscross at one instant, and that turned everything around. But all coincidence. You're not forced to see anything special about the Megillah. But when you read it all together, it opens your eyes. That's what he meant. Sit down and write about your life. Because you'll find, you think, you know, today and tomorrow and the next day, but you read what's happened to you in life. You read, make a story. It's unbelievable. Everybody's life is so full of things. When you think about where you arrived after where you started, and it happened in such crazy ways, everybody's got that experience. You went someplace and you met somebody and you got this and you started that and opened your eyes to something and you ended up amazingly, unpredictably different from where, but that you don't see that day to day. But when you put the whole thing together and you see where the Hashgacha of the Kodesh Baruch Hu has brought you, that's an amazing experience. So the underlying idea is that we experience the world by listening to it. But that's only because of the following idea. That the world is speaking, like we said before, which means it moves through time. It's first this and then the next and then the next. Where's all this movement going? To the next world. The next world doesn't speak at all, the next world you see. The next world, there is no time, it's all there at once. So there's nothing to hear in the next world. Hearing means that there's one thing and then it fades into the darkness. Then there's another and fades away into the darkness. That's what hearing means. But seeing is where it's all light. Seeing is where it's all there at once. You and the seen are all one all at once. But in the next world, there's no development. There's no, in the sense that we have here. So everything is experienced all at once. You see it. Which means this. This world is called movement, and that's why it's called Aretz. This is called Aretz, and that's called Shamayim. Heaven, earth, and that's called heaven. The word Aretz in Hebrew, the Medaktikim say it's from the word rat, to run. Because this world is always moving. Even an atom moves. Everything moves and moves and moves and moves. But the next world is called Shamayim. The root of the Hebrew word Shamayim means Shamim. It's there. Anything you can point to and say, that's where it is. Not going any place, that's where it stops. That's the final there of the world, that's called the next world. Which means that when you're moving through this world, it's a movement and a development. The next world, it's all there and there's no movement. The next world is the divine world. That's Hashem's manifestation. So this is the idea. When the Jews were moving through the desert, or when anybody's moving anywhere in life, he's experiencing the world one thing after the next. That means the world's speaking to him. But what happened when the Torah was given? When the Torah was given, it says the next world arrives in this world. That's what happened. It says Hashem came down on the mountain. Hashem came down on the mountain. It doesn't mean like a six-year-old thinks that a man in the sky with a white beard. It doesn't mean that. It means that the world of the infinite, the next world, the world of infinity, arrives in this world. When that happens, there's nowhere to go. This world is only rats running because it's going to the next world. But if the next world would arrive in this world, there'd be no place to go. You with me? There'd be no possibility of going anywhere. And that's why it says that when Hashem appeared on Mount Sinai, nothing moved in the world. It says no bird flew. Not one atom spun. Nothing moved at all. Why? There was nowhere to move. They were there. The only reason the world moves is because it's going somewhere. But when the next world, that's the place where everything's going, arrives here, and it all melts into one, there's nowhere to go, so nothing could move. Because everything reaches its perfection. It says that anybody who was physically maimed in any way was immediately cured. There was no possibility of going any place because it was here. When that happens, you can't hear anything. Because hearing is the experience of one and then the next and then the next. But when the world that's all here and now arrives now, you can only see. So they saw the sounds. You understand? They couldn't hear anything because hearing means it. This and this and this. So the Torah couldn't say this, they heard anything. Because hearing would mean that the world is moving. That means the infinite's not here. So the Torah says they saw it because that's exactly what's happening. That's exactly what it means.